Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really happy for this first part of today's morning show to be welcoming back into our studios Jennifer Sassaman, who's getting to be a very good friend to the morning show. She's on the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And of course, their theater department is a vibrant one, and they are always doing very, very interesting things. And it sounds like their current production, which opens this coming weekend, is no exception to that. It's an intriguing play called The Last Days of Judas Iscariot by Stephen Adlai Gyrgyz. And we have not only the director, Jennifer Sassaman, in the studios, but also three students at Parkside, three theater majors who are members of the cast. We have Colin Kvarik, who is the judge in this courtroom drama. He is a junior theater major. Robin Feltman is a senior, and she portrays someone named Cunningham. Okay, am I reading that right? And of course, the proceedings would not be complete without Satan himself or itself. And he is played by Zach Cooper, who is a senior theater major, what I should think is maybe a dubious honor. But at any rate, we're glad that all three of you can join us. And Jennifer Sassaman, of course, we welcome you back to the program.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here again.
So tell us a little bit about the selection of this particular play to be done at Parkside. And remind us, who decides that? I mean, to what extent is this a choice you got to make for Parkside to undertake this play?
Well, Parkside operates, the theater department there operates on a company model. So actually everybody, faculty, staff, and students are all involved in the selection process. Everybody nominates shows that they would like to work on. And I like to spend my summers catching up on plays that I should have read and I haven't read yet. And so the summer before this past one, I read The Last Days of Judas Iscariot for the first time, and I was just blown away. I thought it was such an extraordinary piece of work, and I just started talking about it to my colleagues, not in a "we should do this play" sort of manner, because I didn't know that we would necessarily be able to do it. It's rather controversial, and I just really loved it. And so other people read it and they said we should do it. And some of the students, I know Zach was familiar with the play before we did it, so I nominated it, and it worked out well in terms of the whole season that we were constructing for the year. But it was a group decision.
And you said you got this excited from reading it.
Yeah.
Not from seeing it. Because I should think, I mean, sometimes that's certainly possible. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, that's the only way you get acquainted with a play is reading it. But I suspect it isn't all that often that simply from reading the script itself, you get that excited about something.
No, in fact, I think I read 20 scripts last summer, and I think I actively disliked 18 of them.
Wow.
And then a couple, well, maybe 15, and a couple of them were sort of, oh, that could have potential. And I thought the whole play of Judas Iscariot, I thought it was so funny. I thought it was so smartly written. And then the play ended, and I had this moment as I read the last line, and I thought, that's it? And then suddenly I started crying. The end really opened itself up to me, and I realized what was happening in the final moments, and I fell in love with the play.
Huh. Zach Cooper, how did you know about this play already?
I had seen a student production of it at Lawrence University up in Appleton that my friend directed, and I knew nothing about it going in to see it, and I just saw it just out of a courtesy to a peer, and, 2 hours later I was, just blown away.
Wow.
Three hours later. Yeah. It's kind of a long show.
Right. We haven't yet said that the central story of this play, again titled The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, is that this is essentially a trial taking place in purgatory, and it's one of what sounds like kind of a perpetual series of trials. And I think a trial for Benedict Arnold has just finished up Are there any other trials that we see, or otherwise is the body of this play taken up with this one proceeding in purgatory with Judas Iscariot?
The body of the play is taken up with this particular trial. The premise is established at the beginning that there is, that hope is a section of purgatory that God set aside for his children who were in limbo. And it's been different things to different civilizations, but now litigation is how people like to process the transition from purgatory to whichever direction you're going. And so Colin plays the judge. There isn't actually a trial for Benedict Arnold. There are a bunch of cases that are being brought to him that he is dismissing.
Mm. Yes.
And Robin plays Fabiana Aziza Cunningham, who is a defense attorney who is bringing the case of Judas Iscariot to the court to try and get him out of hell.
However, Colin did preside over the trial of Attila the Hun.
So he's got
another
some
high-profile case.
You mentioned right off the bat when you mentioned this play that it is controversial. And
indeed.
I mean, maybe in some ways that goes without saying or does not require explanation, but just take that a little further. In what respect has this play been and maybe remains controversial?
Pick one. I don't know.
I think the primary objection that people have to this play is the language that the playwright uses. He has not envisioned this sort of lofty, you know, academic world where saints and sinners converse, you know, in a highfalutin manner. I think what he's done is really smart. He's taken the idea of people raised in poverty and how they would communicate with one another and translate it to how people who are raised in poverty now might communicate with one another. So that involves a fair amount of slang, a fair amount of profanity, and, you know, to have people refer to these saints or the Son of God and be mentioning curse words in the same sentence, I think could set people in the wrong direction, could give them the wrong impression. I think actually this is a stunning play about humanity and about how we all are the architects of our own prisons, that it's not something that is imposed upon us from judgment above, that it's internal.
Hmm.
But it's very colorful.
Mm. Yeah, and the playwright does continue to remind us that certain portions of the Bible story our history, our facts. You know, we have Roman documents. You know, Pontius Pilate existed.
Mm.
St. Matthew has a monologue about how he was a tax collector, and he reminds us, this is not a story. This is fact. This is history.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think sometimes we get carried away with thinking that, you know, Bible stories are just that, stories. But, you know, wherever you believe, there is an element of truth of history to it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or that we think this was a direct transcript from God.
Right.
As we have recorded documents that show how the Bible came to be constructed.
They do debate the validity of the Gospels, too, in terms of historical accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a big contention point.
In this play.
Yes. Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. And another thing that I feel like is, it might be difficult for people of a certain people who are deeply religious, although Colin, I know, is deeply religious and he loves the play.
Oh my gosh.
they really present the story, the relationship of Judas and Jesus as two political radicals who loved each other very much as brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that Judas talks about Jesus is not only, you know, very colorful in terms of the language he uses, but he doesn't talk about him like he's the Son of God. He talks about him like he is a peer or, you know,
a fellow radical.
And also, you know, we don't always use the nicest words when we talk about our family members or the people that we love. We sometimes get angry.
So there's an air of familiarity.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. In reading other plays, I read several of Gyrgis's other plays this summer to try and get a sense of who he is overall as a playwright. And what I saw again and again was that he writes plays that are about the people in the most important relationship they have in their life in crisis.
Hmm.
So Judas and Jesus Jesus is the most important person in Judas Iscariot's life, and their relationship is not in a good place as the play is taking place. But it everything comes from a place of deep love and regret, and I think if people can look past the language and open themselves to the idea that that Judas and Jesus love each other as brothers, mm-hmm. they'll be able to see what's truly remarkable about this play.
Colin.
Jennifer's correct. I am very Catholic. And when I read this play, for anyone that might be a little nervous about seeing it, when I read this play, I expected to be, like, really disappointed. When I finished it, I had the same reaction, that I wound up, like, crying. And just reading the final stage direction, it was like, I was on a plane coming back to the U.S., and I just, like, I'm in this seat surrounded by all these other people, and I just, like, put my hand over my mouth, like, oh, my gosh. what I think Gyrgis does really well, even though this play is the story is kind of dressed in dirty clothes, but in my opinion, it's a profoundly reverent play that is very respectful of its source material, very respectful of the opinions of the audience, and is just really asking you to allow yourself to be challenged and recognize that Judas was a human being with multiple sides. He wasn't evil, necessarily.
Right.
And Jesus also happened to be a human, fully God, also fully man. People had regular relationships with him. Jesus had a favorite food,
Right.
It's a very humanizing, very gritty, very real, emotionally and intellectually real play.
Yeah. Why were you reading it? Were you reading it as someone who'd already been cast in it? Or?
No. I was an incoming student, and I knew I would have to audition for it, so I wanted to know what I was getting myself into.
We generally advise that the students read the plays that we're doing for our season so that they can be prepared for when they come in for their audition.
Robin Feltman, what about your initial exposure to this play? Was it from reading the script, and what was your initial reaction?
It was also from reading the script. Before we'd even announced the season, I had heard from Zach and a couple other students and Jennifer herself that this was just a great play, that I should check it out. And I read it, and I think all of us can probably say that, our initial response was just tears. And I had to reread it because there's so much there. There's so much in between the lines that you have to really, like, even now we've rehearsed the show over and over again, so going through it, there's still more that you can get, and especially this character that I played, so multifaceted, there's so much to her, and just the whole play itself, there's so much to be gained from it.
I do want to say, and we're talking about how this might be perceived by people with a religious background or a Christian background, I should say that this play, you don't have to have any interest in religion to go to see the beauty in this play. This is a very smart play. It's a very funny play. And I think it is a deeply human play across any sort of religious or even, atheist or agnostic backgrounds.
You have brought these three students not only to have them share their thoughts about the play, but also to present a short scene from it.
Yes.
So why don't you set that up for us?
Well, the scene that we're going to do takes place towards the end of the play. So throughout the play, Cunningham has been arguing to try and get Judas Iscariot released from hell. And they've brought witness after witness after witness to testify for or against this. And this is the last, this isn't the last scene of the play, but it's the last courtroom scene. And she has conjured Satan to try and make her final argument. One of the things that Robin has talked to me about in terms of the structure of her character and the structure of the play is that she's calling people back, the people that she calls to the stand, she's trying to get other people to assume responsibility for the choice that Judas made and try to say it's not Judas's fault, it's this person's fault, it's this person's fault, and that her primary argument that she builds to is to get Satan to admit that it's God's fault that this has happened. There has just been a fairly explosive scene where Satan kind of lists all the terrible things about this character, and we all have a list of things we are not proud of, and Satan has sort of forced her to look at her own faults and shortcomings, and then he's reined himself in, and he's back to his charming self, but she's pretty shaken as she heads into this final argument.
All right, so here is a scene from Stephen Adley Gyrgis's The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, three Parkside students, Zach Cooper, Robin Feltman, and Colin Kavarik.
I don't compete with God. God competes with himself.
That's not what I asked you.
I'm trying to answer your question here.
No, you're not trying
your
to answer
Honor,
my question.
Trying to form
Let
a
him
response.
Answer, Cunningham.
But, Your Honor,
quiet. Proceed.
Thank you. Look, I didn't make you people. God did, okay? But there was a design flaw in the creation. He gave you free will, and to balance that out, you were designed to self-correct. However, unlike the free will muscle, the self-correct muscle is not a particular favorite of the Homo sapiens. In fact, I'd say that self-correct falls somewhere between colonoscopy and firing squad on most people's holiday wish lists. At any rate, the truth is, I don't have to actively compete for human souls. I don't have to lull or flatter or tempt or deceive. Because with God at the helm and you people running around wreaking havoc, well, I'll be honest, I spend most of my free time on the sofa watching House of Cards on Netflix.
And what, getting tossed out of heaven, that didn't bother you at all?
There's a concept, Cunningham, called playing the cards you are dealt. One can either choose to accept this, or one can slowly lose their mind, heart, and soul. I'd like to be of more help to you, but really that's all it comes down to.
Is that so?
I'm just a fallen angel trying to make his way through a monotheistic society. Anything else you want to ask?
Your Honor, this witness is clearly lying. I move to strike his entire testimony from the record.
I'll not allow that, sorry. You conjured him. What comes out of his mouth is your responsibility.
But he's obviously lying.
Expand your consciousness, Counselor.
Your Honor!
Unless you have another question, Cunningham, I suggest you step down now.
But, Your Honor,
forward or back, you've been instructed. Now what'll it be?
Why do you love God, Mr. Satan?
What's not to love?
Specifically, Mr. Satan, what specifically do you love about God?
I don't know where to begin.
Pick a spot.
I love God because he is all-powerful and all-forgiving. I love God because his justice is perfect. I love God because God loves me.
God loves you.
Very much. Gift baskets at Christmas, greeting cards in all major holidays.
Well, stop it. If God loved you, then why did he throw you out of his kingdom?
He didn't throw me out. I left.
That's not what it says in the Bible.
Yeah. They fudged that part, you're right. But that's because you people only really respond to fear and threat. If they told you straight up there were no locks on the gates of heaven, well, you'd have no incentive at all to even try to be halfway decent.
So in other words, God lied.
God didn't write the Bible. You do know that, right?
Of course I know that.
Then why would you say that
God
lied?
Mr. Satan, does God love Judas Iscariot, yes or no?
God loves everybody.
And yet Judas is in hell. So what use is God's love to Judas if my client is allowed to languish in damnation?
Your client is free to leave whenever he wants. Oh, in fact, I wish you would. I could use the space.
That's not true, and you know it.
Look, maybe you should sit down
and
catch your
breath. The real truth is that God's love for us is conditional. You failed to meet his conditions, and he threw you in the trash. Judas failed, and he's in a catatonic stupor.
Your client succumbed to despair.
Yes! And if human despair is so powerful as to render God powerless over it, then what does that say about God? It says one of two things. Either God's not all-powerful and therefore useless, or God's love for us is conditional, which renders that love false and unworthy. Which one is it?
Don't take this personally, Cunningham, but your father never really loved or wanted you, right? And the only reason your mother didn't abort you was because she was afraid of scarring. I think she told you that once, didn't she?
Mr. Satan,
just because your parents resented you doesn't mean that God does.
Mr. Satan, I asked you a direct question, and I am demanding from you a direct answer.
And the direct answer is you are completely wrong.
Is God powerless or spiteful? I am ordering you to answer.
You are powerless and spiteful, Cunningham, not God.
Your Honor, he's not answering.
What do you want me to do
about
it?
But he's not answering.
Open your heart to God, Cunningham.
Shut up! Your Honor,
I suggest you step down now, Cunningham.
But I'm not finished.
Then finish.
But, Your Honor, this isn't fair.
It is what it is, Cunningham.
But, Your Honor,
what? Cunningham.
Your Honor, I just...
What? Cunningham, what?
You're a liar.
I'm truly sorry you feel that way.
Ooh. I should say that scene was slightly cleaned up for the radio.
Thank you. And the FCC thanks you as well. Wow. Say a word about casting this play. Was it, I have to say, all three of these actors seem perfectly matched to their particular characters.
I should say they have worked very hard to craft these individuals. There's no typecasting involved here.
But I mean, so in a sense, was it like casting any other play?
You know, I struggled with casting this play more than I usually do. We have an incredible ensemble at Parkside. We have just so much talent. And I think you guys can attest to this, but the callbacks were really interesting. Robin was still doing her internship. She wasn't back. She emailed me a video audition and called back. But, you know, what I had them do is, I don't know, I called back 30 people, 25 people, and I just gave them all scenes, and we spent an evening. They would go off and rehearse in pairs or work on a monologue and then come back and perform. And what I saw happening was this excitement in the room. Everyone was sort of energized by everyone else's performance, and I didn't know what to do. Usually I feel like callbacks are almost a formality because I see something when people audition and it's like, oh, this person works for this part. I just need to see what their chemistry is like with this other performer. And I left and I didn't know what to do. I agonized over this because everybody in the show except for Robin's character, Colin's character, and a few other people, everybody plays multiple roles. So it wasn't even, okay, well, this person's right for this part and this person's right for this part. It was anybody could play these parts. Wow. They're all so good. And so
Well, a great problem to have. Great problem to have. Visually, how do you evoke this sense of purgatory, or is it as sort of gritty and realistic as the writing? I mean, I'm assuming there's no fog machine and there's
actually we do have a hazer.
Oh,
we do have a hazer. The lighting designer Jody Sikas, who's also the department chair, wanted some haze to really pull out the lighting. Our scenic designer and I worked together this summer, and we kind of stumbled into this idea through talking back and forth. I can't even say what was his idea and what was mine. I can say his execution is exquisite. So the first thing is, we're not doing this in a normal stage concept. We're not doing it proscenium, which is where the audience faces the stage flat. We're not doing it in the round, which is where the audience is all around. We're doing something called an alley configuration. So the audience is on two sides and the action happens in the middle. And what we have decided is that one side, because this is purgatory, because this is a courtroom which takes up the body of the play, one side of the courtroom represents not heaven so much as these commercial ideas we have of how you get to heaven. So one side is, you know, it's very beatific. It's crosses and candles and heavenly clouds. And the other side represents the idea of what we think leads you, what we think might lead someone to hell. So it's gritty, it's got graffiti and scaffolding that the actors climb up almost to the ceiling. And then throughout the whole play, everybody is on the stage for the whole play, including Judas Iscariot, who is sitting in a trap. There's a recessed hole in the floor that he spends the entire play sitting in. He even stays there through intermission. He doesn't move.
Wow.
and when the actors are not playing their specific roles, they sit along the sides as the jury to the trial.
What I really like about this setup, Keith Harris, our scenic designer, who's like just a legend at Parkside.
Yeah.
The guy is a wizard. What's beautiful about the alley configuration and the fact that you have the cast kind of acting as this jury the whole time is that everyone's witness to all the events. And you're also witness to other people's reactions. So as an audience member, you'll be seeing audience members watching this as well. That you're being watched by them.
Yeah.
It's just another level to this kind of courtroom experience about morality.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it ends up being even more of a powerfully shared experience, not just you individually encountering this play, but you really have even a bigger sense of encountering it along with all these other audience members and those who are in the play.
Yeah, and as we worked on the staging of it, you know, often the audience is sort of an observer watching, you know, almost they call it the fourth wall, although I guess this would be the second two walls in this case, but the action is sort of compartmentalized. But because this is a courtroom drama, through so much of this, one of the things that we were constantly talking about is you're not just talking to the lawyer who's questioning you. You're not just talking to the jury. You're talking to the full room. Nobody goes into a court and only talks to the witness. They talk to everybody in the room.
Right.
So that the audience is very much included in the conversation.
Mm. It does sound really powerful. You've also said that it's a funny play.
It is a funny
although play. Although there wasn't much that was funny in the scene that you just did. What is kind of the proportion of drama to comedy, would you say?
Well, I think this functions like any sort of a blended play that has a serious message but has a comic element to it. It starts off a lot funnier, although not in the opening monologue, which is heartbreaking. But the opening monologue is done is Judas Iscariot's mother talking about her love for her son.
Wow.
Which I think is very smart, is a way to immediately start the play saying, let's leave your notions of this evil betrayer behind and think this was somebody's son, somebody who loved them. But there's a lot more comedy in the first act than there is in the second act. But it's layered. So it's more like it's more funny than sad in the first act, and it's more sad than funny in the second act. But that there's humor and drama blended throughout.
Wow. It sounds amazing. It sounds absolutely
amazing. We are very excited.
Yeah. Has it been complicated to put together in any surprising ways?
This has been a shockingly painless process.
I'd have to say that out of all the rehearsal processes I've done at Parkside, I think this has been one of the most, like, where everyone's been gung-ho the whole time. Like, people were really striving to get off book before the off-book date.
Yeah, director loves
and, yeah, that. Each day was something new. People were trying new things up until, like, last week, up until, like, last night. You'll see, like, someone says a line just a little differently, and you're like, oh, wow, I've never heard that line like that before. Wow. So, yeah, people have been very enthusiastic
that
as
level
cast
of engagement
and crew.
Is exciting.
Very professional.
Cool.
Yeah. Very professional.
Great. So we're talking about The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, which opens this weekend and it runs the following weekend.
Correct.
As well in the Black Box
in
Theater.
In the Black Box Theater.
Which is a really special space to experience the theater. Real quick before we go, Colin Kavarik, you're a junior. Where are you from originally?
I am from Mundelein, Illinois.
Oh, not too far away.
Yeah, I've been visiting Parkside for quite a while, though. I just got my associate's degree from the College of Lake County in Grays Lake, Illinois. But I've been I saw How I Learned to Drive in, what year was that, 2014?
Yep.
I think.
Like,
and I was interested in coming to the school immediately.
Ah.
And so I had like four tours before I actually became a student.
Oh, very good.
Keith knew me already. Like, I saw a Midsummer Night's Dream, and Keith gave me a hug and said, welcome home, before I even applied. So I was like, I got to go here.
Cool. Yeah. Well, we're glad you did. Robin, where are you from, Robin Feltman?
I'm from right here in Kenosha.
Oh, really? Where'd you go to school?
Tremper.
Oh, okay. So you've already tasted some wonderful theater that way, didn't you?
Yep. I'd been going to Parkside for years. I knew people who went through the program, and I knew that was the only school I wanted to go to.
Very good. How about you, Zach? Zach Cooper?
Like Robin, I'm from Kenosha. I went to Tremper High School, and I'd been seeing shows at Parkside since, you know, like 2008 religiously.
Ah.
And knowing that, like, wow, this is a special place for theater. And doing theater in high school, it seemed almost like obvious that it's like, yeah, I want to end up here.
Very good. Well, all three of you are terrific in your respective roles, and we want to remind people of Stephen Adley Girgis's The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, opening this weekend and running the following weekend as well. And you should call 595-2564 if you want more information, or go to boxoffice@uwp.edu.
That's the email. You can just go to the department website and click on box office if you want to order tickets online, but these are other options as well.
Very good. So for The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, director Jennifer Sassaman, Zach Cooper, Robin Feltman, Colin Kavarik, great to talk with all of you. Very best wishes with what sounds like an absolutely tremendous experience of theater at UW Parkside. And thank you for being here today on The Morning Show.
Thank you so much.
Here's part two of today's Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I like nothing more than to be introduced to an important person about whom I've never heard a word. And that's really the case with the New York Times bestseller, Dr. Mütter's Marvels, which introduces us to the very important figure of Thomas Dent Mütter, a very important doctor and surgeon from the 19th century who, as much as anyone, helped to revolutionize the way that medicine was practiced, and especially the way in which surgery was practiced. And he was a gifted and in some ways incredibly flamboyant man, and he had a wonderful way with words. And so what he said about the profession of medicine is absolutely captivating, as is this book about him, Dr. Mütter's Marvels, a true tale of intrigue and innovation at the dawn of modern medicine, written by the award-winning author Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. And she is born and raised in Philadelphia, where much of the story of Dr. Thomas Dent Mütter unfolds. And he is still very well known in the city of Philadelphia, not as well known as he should be, given his importance. And so I am so happy to have had the opportunity to read this endlessly fascinating book. And now I have a few precious minutes to speak with the author, Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, about this book published by Avery, an imprint of Penguin Random House. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really happy to be here.
And I'm happy to be talking to someone who lives in Philadelphia, where I happen to have a brother who lives. And was I overstating it when I said that the city of Philadelphia well knows the name of Thomas Dent Mütter better than the rest of us do?
Absolutely. It is the home of the Mütter Museum, which is a museum of 19th century medical oddities. And so if you grew up in Philly, this was a place you went to a lot on field trips and school trips, and it just became a part of the culture of being a kid and growing up in Philly. And it wasn't until I left Philly that I realized there was anything unusual about it and that not every kid grows up with a medical oddity science museum in their childhood. And that's how I first became interested in learning more about the man who founded it.
Absolutely.
Of which little was known.
And I want us to talk about that. I want to give you maybe 40 seconds to just list a couple of the really interesting things that are found at that museum. I mean, I think it's important for people to appreciate that.
Absolutely. Well, there's Madame Dimanche. She's a woman who had a horn that started growing from the center of her forehead. She's actually from Dr. Mütter's original collection. We have the death cast and conjoined liver of Chang and Ang, the famous sideshow act, the conjoined twins, which gave us the term Siamese twins. They have a 9-foot megacolon that was extracted from a human being who is known as the human balloon. The megacolon is so popular that they actually sell a plushy version of the megacolon in their gift store, so you could take it home with you. You have the Hurdle Skull Collection, which is skulls collected from all over the world to disprove the concept of phrenology, the idea that you can tell people's character through ridges on their skulls. You have, limbs in jars. The thing I couldn't handle was the wall of eye trauma, essentially a wall of eyeballs of which awful things have all happened to them and how we would treat such a thing. It's a pretty, I wouldn't suggest, I've had now 2 book release parties at the museum, and I always say I save a lot on catering because no one wants to eat after visiting the museum.
Right. Of course, the thing that's interesting is that museum, it brings his name to the public, but in a sense it doesn't necessarily help us understand just how important he was and what a revolutionary figure he was. Explain how the state of medicine was in such a state that Dr. Mütter found it so deeply objectionable. I think most of us don't know enough about early medicine before it really began to enjoy scientific rigor.
Exactly. I mean, even the tools. I mean, that's one of the things I must have thought was so frustrating, is to have an innate instinct towards things like germ theory, right? The idea that diseases can be and infections can be spread through, contact with an infected surface, whether that's a hand or a tool. That was not proven, really, until the invention of the modern microscope in the late 1800s. Mütter died in 1859. So he, his belief that you should wash your hands and tools prior to surgery was seen as a feat and weak. One of his colleagues at the university he taught at, Miggs, with whom he clashed a lot with, used to be offended at the idea that doctors would wash their hands prior to seeing patients because, quote, it insisted that doctors were not gentlemen because all gentlemen were clean men. So the idea that doctors were actually taking stances against washing your hands and tools gives you a clue of what 19th century was like. They didn't have electric lighting, so all surgeries were done by candlelight or sunlight. They didn't have ether anesthesia. All surgery patients were awake during their procedures, and in fact, a part of the service was men would be paid to hold you down on the surgical surgical table, both to keep you still during the surgery, but also to prevent you from running away. You did not need a license to practice medicine. You did not need a degree to practice medicine. You literally could just say you were a doctor, hang a shingle outside of your house, and begin putting leeches on people. It was a real wild, wild west. And during Mutter's lifetime, you know, the changes that made for what we know and enjoy as modern medicine today began to fall into place. And Mutter himself was at the forefront of it. You know, he really viewed medicine and practiced medicine in a way that I think today we would all love to be treated. And this was, you know, decades before some of his theories would be proven. So he was really forward thinking and, you know, a great hero in my mind.
You connect him to the city of Paris, France, in several different ways.
Yes.
How important was that in terms of shaping the kind of doctor that he was? I mean, living and working in Paris, was that an important contributing factor in the groundbreaking work which he did?
Absolutely. You know, back in the 19th century, you know, if you were going to study medicine, you could not really be an exceptional doctor, you know, one who worked in the highest stratas, unless you were already born into a wealthy class, because wealthy people would only trust, you know, other wealthy people at that time period. You wouldn't take someone whose background you didn't know to examine your wife. You know, that was just seen as completely implausible. The only field in which you could really come from the background that Mutter did, Mutter was a poor orphan, and succeed and make a name for yourself was surgery, because it was something where skill would outweigh any other factor. You know, if you were going to have your leg cut off and you were awake during the surgery, you kind of didn't care if that guy knew your dad. You know, what you cared about was, would it be done cleanly, as with as least pain as possible, and would you survive the surgery? In order to be the best surgeon possible, Mutter, you know, kind of tricked his way over to Paris to study with the best surgery being done in the world at that time period, and came across the field of study which he would become known for, which over there was called operations plastique, and what today we would know as plastic surgery or reconstructive surgery. And this was an area of surgery that was brand new to modern medicine. Obviously, if you were having surgeries done on you while you were awake, you would only want that to happen if it was a life or death situation, essentially elective surgery, right? Wanting to help fix a deformity or disfigurement by choice was not something a lot of people made, unless they were certain that that the outcome would make their life better and happier, and that they would survive the surgery. And Mutter saw plastic surgery for the first time in Paris and knew immediately that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to come back to America and reach out to these populations of patients that were completely underserved. I mean, the severely deformed back then were literally categorized medically as monsters. That was a medical term, in the way that idiot was a medical term. And he saw these people as human beings. You know, he was very sick throughout his entire life, and especially through his childhood. And he knew what it was like to be a patient and knew what it was like to not be treated well by the doctors who were tasked with healing you. And he knew that this was a population that did not get the respect it deserved.
Right.
So he went in back to America and did revolutionary work. The surgeries that he did and invented were so forward-thinking that some of them are still being used today.
We should mention that early in his life, he actually received some very good care from physicians. I think it was something where they were sort of spelling out very clearly what his future was likely to be physically, and he so appreciated the care he received that that's one of the things that inspired him to pursue a medical profession.
Absolutely. That sort of clarity and transparency was not a part of 19th century medicine. People rarely sought the help of doctors and only in extreme situations. And doctors, you know, again, if you're performing work on a patient without any sort of painkiller or anesthetic, it's going to be excruciating for that person. And you're just going to have to ignore their screams and cries to get the work done that you know needs to be done. So there was a big gulf between patient and doctor. And doctors were sort of trained to sort of ignore their patients. And Mutter just took a stride against it. And you could see that in the work that he did. I mean, one of the things that is, I think, most apparent metaphor is he was the inventor of what we know to be the modern recovery room. you know, prior to that, if you had surgeries done in a surgical clinic, they just put you in sort of an unwashed wagon and rode you home over the cobblestone streets of Philadelphia. Mutter was appalled by this. You know, he was doing these very delicate surgeries, and he didn't want infection to set in. He didn't want the stitches to be disrupted by rattling in a wagon, and he insisted that the college that he taught at, Jefferson Medical College, build recovery rooms, and they refused. They just did not see the reason for it. And Mutter was so adamant that this be done that he himself used his own money to rent a floor above a restaurant and would move his patients into that floor and watch over them along with the help of his students. To that today, that seems like common sense. Of course you would do that. But back then, it was just unheard of. So that's an example of the humanist philosophies that Mutter put into practice that really put the patient and the patient's care front and center instead of the infallible, you know, dictations of the doctor, which was definitely the way 19th century medicine, you know, moved.
It's especially fascinating in your book to read about the battle over anesthesia and the fact that and Dr. Mutter did not invent anesthesia, but he was one of its most persuasive champions. And your book outlines the reservations that most other doctors had about anesthesia, in particular the fact that some doctors relied on the what the patient would tell them through the course of the surgery, and the idea that of the patient being out cold during the surgery. How are we going to talk to them then? but for other reasons too, some of them just could not open themselves up to this notion.
And
it's fascinating to read of Dr. Mutter's tenacious insistence that this was the only humane way to do surgery.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty shocking, you know. In researching Dr. Mutter's marvels, you know, I'd always thought that scientific progress was sort of, you know, a march up a mountain, you know, innovation building upon innovation. And when you would have something like, ether anesthesia surgery being, you know, essentially invented, that doctors would flock to it. Oh, my God, this is clearly the next thing. To realize that there was a battle against it, that hospitals banned it, was shocking to me. But again, when you view it through the lens of the 19th century, it began to make more sense. You know, one of the reasons he spoke about was that doctors throughout time had performed surgeries on and learned from their patients who were awake during the surgeries. So if you were talking to a patient and he began to sort of fade away and you realize, oh, this patient is at risk of bleeding out, and if I don't stop the surgery now, they're going to die on my table. If the patient is already unconscious, how would you ever get that information before you had the medical tools that we have today? Another reason was because of the lack of standardized medicine. You know, it's another thing I always took for granted of. I don't expect the Tylenol I buy in New York City to be different than the Tylenol I buy in Chicago. But back then, you know, your jar of ether could have varying strength depending on who made it or where it was made or when it was made. So the surgeries themselves were with a very unstable chemical. And the last one was sort of the most surprising to me, which was before germ theory was really proven, doctors did not wash their hands and tools, and the death rates of people who had surgery under ether versus surgery while they were awake were pretty much exactly the same, which is shocking. You would think that a thrashing, you know, person on the table would cause a lot more deaths than someone who was calmly knocked out. But it was the infections after the surgeries that were the real killers of 19th century medicine.
And it didn't matter how the surgery was done, in a sense. I mean,
right. Exactly. And so it was really the doctor's choice. If the doctor says, you know, it doesn't seem to affect their death rates, they die at the same rate, whether or not they're knocked out enough, and I don't trust this chemical, and I've done surgeries with people awake the whole time, it's my choice whether or not I want to do this. Then it kind of makes sense. But of course, as a patient, you would think you would choose to be knocked out every time. Unfortunately, at that time in medicine, we were not given the option of whether or not we would want that service. But, you know, those sorts of things just made researching Dr. Mutter's marvels such a pleasure. You know, I really, you know, fell in love with that time period and the debates and the, you know, discoveries that were happening. Everything was so new, and you have people like Mutter who had a vision. You know, Mutter was fastidiously clean. He knew innately, and perhaps from being a patient himself, the difference between a clean doctor and a dirty doctor, and knew that being clean, fastidiously so, is going to help your patient in the long run. But his theories on this wouldn't be proven for 50 years after his death. You know, it's incredible what he was forced to endure for things that would later be, you know, proven with a microscope or proven with an X-ray.
A man truly ahead of his time who made life better for so many people.
Yes.
And your book tells the story so brilliantly. The book, again, is Dr. Mutter's Marvels, a New York Times bestseller now, available in paperback. Kristen O'Keefe Aptewitz, its author. Kristen O'Keefe Aptewitz, congratulations on an absolutely spectacular book. I loved every page. And thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's the monthly visit of the UEC, the United Environmental Council. Nan Calvert will be with us in the studios and we'll be speaking with someone from Wisconsin's DNR. On Friday, we look forward to a return visit from Jack Rose, who is with the local chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. October is National Mental Illness Awareness Month, and so Friday is a great opportunity for us to talk with Jack Rose about some of the special challenges and issues which confront not only the mentally ill, but those who love and care for the mentally ill. And we'll find out from Jack Rose his own personal story, his own very personal connection to the cause of mental illness awareness in our country. So that's on Friday's Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and you find the program archived on our website, which is WGTD.org. A reminder that Wisconsin Public Radio's Fall Pledge Drive is currently underway. And if you have not yet done so, I really hope that you will take a moment to pledge your financial support to Wisconsin Public Radio. You can do so by calling toll-free 1-888-202-2552. That's 1-888-202-2552. Or you can contact them through their website, which is WPR.org, WPR.org. Either way, the process takes just a few moments of your time and could not be simpler, but it's important that you are part of the increasing community of support for WGTD and for Wisconsin Public Radio. We thank you for your support and for your interest. Once again, that toll-free number to call Wisconsin Public Radio is 1-888-202-2552, or contact them via their website, WPR.org. And thank you. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Today is going to be a partly sunny day, mild, a high of 69 degrees, partly cloudy overnight with a low of 52 degrees. Tomorrow, Thursday, will be cloudy, windy, warmer, but with rain showers very likely all day long. Tomorrow's high, 75 degrees, and then our temperatures fall back on Friday to 58 degrees, back up into the 60s on Saturday, and back up into the 70s by early next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News.